If you asked the average news pundit today what the word Sharia means, they would almost certainly picture this really rigid courtroom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Or like a strict judge pounding a gavel.
Right. But looking at the massive stack of notes you've brought us for this deep dive, the concept, well, it doesn't start with a judge.
No, it really doesn't.
And it doesn't even start in a city. It begins with a literal, like, life or death survival path to a watering hole in the Arabian desert.
Exactly. The linguistic root of the letters are historically referred to watering animals at a permanent waterhole, or the physical pathway you actually had to follow to get there.
Wow.
Because in a harsh, arid desert environment, wandering off that path didn't just mean getting lost. I mean, it meant you didn't survive.
You die.
Right. So over time, that literal pathway to water was adopted as a metaphor for a divinely ordained way of life.
Which makes total sense, right? Like, a path to water is literally a path to life. So the metaphor naturally becomes the path a believer has to follow to reach spiritual sustenance.
Precisely. It's the path that keeps you spiritually alive.
Now, before we really get into the weeds here, I want to clarify something for you, the listener. Because you've handed us a stack of sources today on what is arguably one of the most politically charged topics on earth.
Oh, without a doubt. It touches on theology, human rights, democracy, everything.
Exactly. So I want to explicitly state our mission here today. Our only job in this deep dive is to act as your high-level scouts. We aren't here to referee theology or debate democracy or take any political sides whatsoever.
Right, we're strictly impartial today.
Totally impartial. We are simply mapping out exactly what your sources say about how the system actually worked, where it came from, and, how it collides with the modern world. We're just conveying the ideas as they exist in the text.
And honestly, the absolute best place to start that mapping is with a distinction in your notes that, well, it clears up about 90% of the public confusion right out of the gate.
Oh, really? What's the distinction?
It's the fundamental difference between two concepts, Sharia and Fiqh.
Okay, Sharia and Fiqh.
Right. So in classical Islamic theology, Sharia is the divine ideal. It is the perfect, flawless, immutable law as set down by God.
But the notes stress that Sharia itself is mostly intangible, right? It's like this ultimate ideal. The
Exactly.
actual laws that got applied in historical societies, those fall under Fiqh, which translates to Islamic jurisprudence.
Yes, Fiqh is the human attempt to understand it.
So is this kind of like the concept of true north on a compass versus the actual map drawn by a human cartographer? Like, true north Sharia is fixed and perfect, but Fiqh is the map drawn by a flawed human trying to figure out how to get there.
That is a brilliant analogy.
Yeah.
Yes. And taking that compass analogy further, because humans are the ones drawing the map, you inevitably get different borders and different routes.
Depending on who's holding the pen, right?
Exactly. And when they are drawing it, the human attempt to interpret the divine is inherently fallible.
Which means mistakes happen.
Right. That is why Islamic history isn't just one giant monolithic legal code. I mean, it is filled with different competing schools of law. These human cartographers developed entirely different methodologies for deriving everyday rulings from the sacred texts.
And your sources point out that this framework isn't totally unique to Islam, which I found fascinating.
Oh, yeah, the parallels are striking.
You see a very strong structural parallel in Jewish law, halakha, which actually also translates to the path to follow.
Yes, it's the exact same metaphorical concept.
Both traditions rely heavily on a revealed textual law that then requires this really intense ongoing interpretation by a class of highly trained scholars.
Which naturally leads us to the methodology those scholars actually use. I mean, if you are a medieval jurist trying to draw this map of Fiqh, you don't just guess.
Right, you need tools, you need a system.
Exactly. Traditional Sunni jurisprudence recognizes a strict hierarchy of four primary sources to build the law. First is the Quran, obviously. Second is the Sunnah, which are the recorded traditions and sayings of Muhammad.
Okay, so those first two establish the baseline scriptural texts.
Right.
But looking at your notes on how they built this law, the third and fourth sources are what really caught my eye. Because they basically solve the time travel problem.
Non-travel problem.
Yeah. I mean, the sacred texts are finite, right? They were written at a specific time. Time keeps moving. New stuff gets invented. So their third tool to handle that is ijma, right? The consensus of the scholarly community.
Yes, ijma. And the underlying theological justification there is really interesting. There's a recorded tradition stating that the Islamic community would never unanimously agree on an error.
Wow. So if all the experts agree, it becomes law.
Essentially, yes. If the top tier of legal minds across the empire reach a consensus on an issue, that consensus gains the force of law. But the real engine of daily legal adaptation, the thing that keeps the law moving forward, is the fourth source, chaos.
Chaos, which means analogical reasoning, right?
Exactly, analogical reasoning.
The sources gave a brilliant example of chaos in action. Let's see if I have this right. So the text explicitly forbids the drinking of wine.
Right, that's firmly in the text.
But then fast forward a few centuries, and entirely new intoxicating drugs appear on the scene. A strict literalist reading would say, well, you know, the text only mentions wine made from grapes, so this new chemical powder is perfectly fine.
Which obviously defeats the whole moral purpose of the law. So, using chaos, a jurist looks beneath the literal text to identify what they call the illa.
The illa.
Yeah, it translates to the effective cause of the ruling. The jurist asks, okay, why is wine forbidden?
Because it intoxicates you.
Exactly. The cause is intoxication. Therefore, they analogize the new substance to the old one. If the new drug intoxicates, the prohibition against wine legally extends to it.
That is so elegant. It's a highly rational mechanism for the law to adapt to new technologies and new substances without requiring a new prophet or, you know, brand new scripture.
It really is. It makes the system incredibly resilient.
Wait, but here is where your stack of notes introduces a massive historical contradiction. Because you just laid out this immaculate orthodox theory where the law flows perfectly down from divine texts through consensus and careful analogy.
Right, that's the traditional view.
But your notes from modern historians, specifically this revisionist school led by scholars like Joseph Schott, they paint a completely different picture of how this actually happened on the ground.
Oh, completely. The revisionist view fundamentally challenges that neat, top-down traditional narrative.
How so?
Well, Schacht and others point out that the early Arab empires expanded at a blinding speed in the 7th and 8th centuries. I mean, they conquered highly populated, very complex urban societies.
Like the Persian and Byzantine territories.
Exactly. And those territories already had their own deeply entrenched administrative needs and laws. The revisionist argument is that early Islamic law wasn't drawn up in a vacuum from scripture alone.
But what did they do?
They aggressively absorbed the existing pre-Islamic customs and the common laws of the conquered peoples, and then only later on gave them an Islamic theological justification.
The archaeological examples in your notes regarding this are wild. They point to pre-Islamic Sephardic inscriptions that detail pilgrimage rituals that look strikingly similar to later Islamic practices.
Yes.
Or even crazier, look at the pre-Islamic tribal concept of qisas. In tribal Arab society, if someone was murdered, the victim's tribe would demand the execution of a social equal from the murderer's tribe.
Right. It was pure intertribal blood feuding. An eye for an eye, but based on social rank.
Yet, as the empire formed, that raw, brutal tribal custom was absorbed and domesticated into the legal code.
It was. It was transformed into a system of civil dispute resolution between individual believers.
Which is such a massive shift.
It really is. Instead of the state prosecuting a murder like we're used to, it was treated as a private dispute where the victim's family could demand equal retaliation. Or, and this is crucial, they could accept dia.
Dia is the financial compensation, right? Blood money.
Exactly. They could accept blood money instead of an execution.
So how does a listener reconcile a divine, perfect law with historical evidence that they seemingly just copied and pasted tribal blood money rules and Byzantine administrative laws?
That's the big question. And you reconcile it by understanding that the human cartographers we discussed earlier, the jurists, they were incredibly pragmatic.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning they believed the divine intention was to establish a just and functional society. If a local Byzantine market regulation or a tribal dispute mechanism served the public good and it didn't directly contradict the core monotheistic theology.
And they just integrated it.
Exactly. They Islamicized the local customs. The law was a living, breathing synthesis of divine text and social utility from day one.
Which entirely changes how you view their system of categorizing human behavior. Because they didn't just regulate murders and big market disputes. Your notes on the Occam the Five Decisions show a framework that covers microscopic daily habits.
Oh, it covers everything. Every single human action is dropped into one of five buckets: mandatory, recommended, neutral, reprehensible, and forbidden.
See, bringing categories like neutral or recommended into a legal code radically changes the nature of a courtroom. It transforms the law from just a strictly punitive list of thou shalt nots into, like, a comprehensive ethical map.
That's a great way to put it, an ethical map. For example, brushing your teeth in a specific manner might be recommended. Drinking a glass of water is neutral.
And wasting water while washing your hands might be reprehensible, meaning it's sinful, right?
Right.
But a judge is going to throw you in jail for it.
Exactly. The worldly courts only really deal with the extremes, the mandatory and the forbidden. The rest is about personal spiritual ethics.
But if the law is that granular, if it covers exactly how you wash your hands, that creates a massive problem for you, the listener, trying to understand how this survives.
What do you mean?
Well, how does a medieval framework governing daily habits survive the invention of the printing press or the modern global banking system? If the rules are that stubbornly specific, the system should have just snapped centuries ago.
It would have if it were entirely rigid. But the system survived because of a built-in tension between two legal mechanisms, ijtihad and taqlid.
Okay, break those down for us.
Sure. So ijtihad is the intense, independent mental effort by a highly qualified legal scholar to derive a ruling for a totally unprecedented situation.
So that's the innovation side.
Right, and it requires a staggering mastery of Arabic, theology, and precedent. You can't just be a guy on the street.
And taqlid is essentially the opposite, right?
Yes, taqlid is conforming to precedent, relying on the established decisions of previous masters. Because, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel every time someone asks a basic question about how to pray.
So there's this balance between innovating and relying on the old masters.
Exactly. And the historical debate has always been over whether the gates of ijtihad were ever formally closed by medieval scholars.
Why would they close them?
To prevent unqualified people from just making up laws, but many argue the duty to apply independent reasoning remained open. And to guide that independent reasoning, jurists developed a concept called maqasid.
Maqasid, which translates to the overarching aims or objectives of Sharia.
Correct. And your sources highlight the 11th century philosopher Al-Ghazali here. His framework is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I love this part, because he argued the divine law wasn't just this random list of arbitrary tests for humanity. The ultimate goal was human welfare.
Exactly. Al-Ghazali identified five core essentials that the law is fundamentally designed to protect: religion, life, intellect, offspring, and property.
So his logic dictates that any legal ruling that protects those five essentials serves the public interest, and anything that harms them violates the spirit of Sharia.
Precisely. It's a very utilitarian way of looking at divine law.
And think about what that means for the modern world. Modern scholars are picking up this exact 11th century Maqasid framework and using it to argue for incredibly contemporary concepts.
Oh, they use it constantly today.
Right. They argue that if the ultimate divine goal of Sharia is to protect the human intellect and property, then democratic elections, freedom of speech, and women's property rights. They aren't Western imports at all.
No, they frame them as the purest modern expressions of Sharia.
Exactly. They use this medieval philosophy to argue for a highly fluid, progressive application of the law today.
It is a brilliant intellectual maneuver, honestly. It bridges classical theology with modern governance. However, there's a big however. The theoretical elegance of protecting human welfare heavily collides with the area of Sharia that grabs all the modern headlines: the criminal justice system.
Oh, yeah. We absolutely have to dig into the criminal law section of your notes, because the reality of how these courts historically function is deeply counterintuitive.
It really is. The sources divide Islamic criminal law into three distinct categories.
Right. And the first one is had.
Yes, have. These are crimes considered to be committed directly against God's limits, and they carry specific, severe punishments detailed directly in the scriptural texts.
This is where you find the punishments that shock the modern conscience,
yeah.
Right? Like amputation for theft or stoning for certain sexual offenses.
Exactly. That's hadid. The second category, as we discussed earlier, is qisas and diya. That deals with bodily harm and murder, treating it as a civil dispute between the families involved.
Right, the blood money stuff. And then the third category is tazir, which covers offenses that just have no specified scriptural punishment.
Right. With tazir, the judge or the state has almost complete discretion to determine the penalty based on the severity of the crime.
And the notes indicate the vast majority of historical criminal cases were handled under this discretionary tazir category, not had.
Yes. And the reason the vast majority fell under tazir brings us to one of the most critical sociological mechanisms in all of Islamic jurisprudence.
Yes. The evidentiary catch-22 regarding those extreme had punishments. This blew my mind.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
Because you read the headlines today and you just assume these brutal punishments were being handed out constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But your notes detail how the classical jurists engineered a system deliberately designed to make executing these punishments nearly impossible.
Completely impossible in many cases. Let's take the crime of adultery. The foundation for the law goes back to a famous incident known as the necklace story involving Aisha, who was the prophet's wife.
Okay, what happened?
After she was falsely accused of infidelity, a strict evidentiary rule was established to prevent slander and protect reputations. To secure a conviction for adultery under Had, the court required 4 adult male eyewitnesses.
4 eyewitnesses?
Well, not just circumstantial evidence, not just seeing 2 people enter a room together or seeing them holding hands. 4 eyewitnesses who saw the actual physical act of penetration occur.
Which, I mean, you might be wondering, how could anyone ever meet that burden of proof?
You can't, not unless they are doing it in the middle of the town square.
Right. And that is the entire point.
Yeah.
Because here's the second half of the catch-22. If you bring an accusation of adultery to the court, but you can only produce, say, 3 eyewitnesses instead of 4,
the case is thrown out.
And you, the accuser, receive 80 lashes for the crime of slander.
Wow. Think about the chilling effect of that.
It's massive. The classical jurists deliberately constructed an evidentiary threshold that was practically insurmountable.
They did. And the aha moment here is understanding their motivation. The jurists weren't just being lenient for the sake of it. They were actively managing state power.
How so?
Well, they believed the primary goal of the Had punishments was deterrence through the sheer terror of the theoretical threat. They wanted to maintain public morality by keeping this scary punishment on the books.
But they also knew that actually executing people or chopping off hands causes massive social unrest. It fractures communities.
Exactly. So they engineered a legal paradox. They kept the terrifying divine threat on the books to uphold the theological ideal, but they rigged the procedural rules to ensure the state almost never had the legal authority to actually execute the punishment for a moral failing.
It's wild. The system prioritized preserving life and social harmony over retributive violence.
It is a masterful piece of sociological engineering. But, and this is a huge, but that intricate balance, where independent jurists acted as a buffer between the raw text and the citizens, that was completely upended by the arrival of the modern era.
Which leads us to the final major section of your notes. How does a system run by independent scholars drawing these fluid maps survive the invention of the modern nation state? And frankly, the onslaught of European colonialism.
The short answer is it didn't, not in its classical form.
It broke down.
Yeah. The 19th and 20th centuries forced a massive paradigm shift. As Muslim-majority countries centralized power into modern nation-states, they couldn't rely on hundreds of independent scholars issuing varied, conflicting opinions.
Right. A modern state needs uniform laws.
Exactly. So the state took over the law. They began codifying their laws into rigid, formal statutes, effectively freezing those fluid maps into state-mandated borders.
And your sources show this resulted in a hybrid system in a lot of these countries. The governments imported European civil codes, like French or British models, to handle commercial and criminal law because, well, they needed to interface with the global economy.
Right. You can't trade globally if your commercial laws are completely incompatible with the rest of the world.
So they restricted Sharia primarily to family law, marriage, divorce, inheritance.
Yes. The independent scholar was replaced by a government committee. But human nature dictates that everyday believers still crave moral guidance for their daily lives. Stuff outside the scope of a government family court.
And that craving sparked the fascinating modern evolution of the fatwa.
It really did.
Because historically, your notes explain that a fatwa was an incredibly dense, technical legal brief. An independent scholar would issue a fatwa to a judge to help resolve an unprecedented legal question in a specific court case.
It was essentially the equivalent of a Supreme Court amicus brief. Very high-level stuff.
But today, the fatwa has been completely democratized, and as a result, it is deeply fragmented. Because the state took over the formal courts, independent religious scholars just migrated to new platforms.
Oh, yeah. We are talking about internet forums, satellite TV call-in shows, and now social media.
It's crazy. You have everyday people texting questions to a scholar in another country, seeking a fatwa on the most modern dilemmas imaginable.
Give me some examples from the notes.
Oh, they are fascinating. Uh-huh. There are fatwas addressing the permissibility of cryptocurrency, the ethics of medical sex change operations, and my absolute favorite, whether a Muslim astronaut on the International Space Station still needs to pray facing Mecca when the Earth is literally spinning below them.
That is incredible, and it represents the ultimate decentralization of religious authority. Anyone with a smartphone can now seek out a scholar whose specific map, going back to our analogy, aligns with their personal views.
But this decentralization also fuels the intense, often violent ideological clashes we see globally today.
It does. It really does.
Looking at the contemporary flashpoints in your sources, we see a massive, active collision between ancient texts and modern global standards. And again, acting as your neutral scouts here, we aren't judging the validity of either side, just mapping the terrain of the friction.
Right. So on one flank of this friction, you have fundamentalist and revivalist movements. They view the historical codification and European influence as a complete corruption.
They want to go back.
Exactly. They demand a return to what they view as a pure implementation of Sharia. And they frequently push to reinstate those severe head punishments as a direct rejection of Western modernity.
But then on the opposing flank, you have the modernist scholars we discussed earlier. Mm. The ones using the Makassi, the welfare objectives, to argue that the classical text must be reinterpreted to align perfectly with the UN Declaration of Human Rights.
And the friction points between these two sides are highly specific in the sources.
Oh, totally. Your notes highlight the European Court of Human Rights explicitly ruling that a specific political implementation of Sharia was completely incompatible with democratic pluralism.
Yeah, that was a landmark ruling.
There are ongoing fierce debates within these countries regarding apostasy laws, like whether the state can punish someone for changing their religion. The tension is incredibly high regarding women's rights, particularly in inheritance distribution and domestic violence laws, where traditional literalist readings clash violently with modern egalitarian views.
And similarly, classical jurisprudence faces massive pushback from contemporary frameworks regarding LGBTQ rights.
You're watching a real-time battle over who gets to draw the map for the 21st century. But, and this is where the deep dives takes a really surprising turn, the impact of these legal frameworks isn't restricted to just social rights or criminal courts.
No, it's not. There is a profound, often overlooked economic consequence hidden in the structure of classical Sharia.
I am so glad we have time for this, because the economic theory from Timur Kuan in your notes provides a massive aha moment regarding global history.
I love this theory. It really changes how you view history.
It does. Because we often wonder why the Middle East, which was historically the absolute center of global trade and wealth, fell behind Europe economically in the early modern period.
Right. And Kuran theorizes it comes down to a single missing legal concept in classical Sharia, the corporation.
The corporation.
Mm.
Which sounds so dry, but the implications are staggering.
They are. Because in classical Islamic jurisprudence, the law only recognized natural living human beings. It had no concept of a fictitious legal person, what we call a corporation, which can own assets, take on debt, and exist entirely independently of its human founders.
Okay, so if I start a business, it's just my business. It doesn't exist outside of me.
Exactly. And you have to combine that missing concept with the incredibly strict Quranic inheritance laws. The text mandates that wealth must be distributed among a very wide network of extended family members upon a person's death.
So you couldn't just leave your entire business to your eldest son to keep it intact.
No, you legally had to fracture it. Functionally, this meant that if a highly successful merchant built a massive, booming shipping enterprise, the moment he died, that enterprise had to be liquidated and fractured into dozens of pieces to satisfy all those inheritance laws.
The business literally died with the human.
Yes.
Which means you couldn't accumulate capital over multiple generations to build a massive multi-century trading company like, say, the Dutch East India Company.
Precisely. Because the legal map lacked the concept of a corporation, it functionally prevented the accumulation of massive generational wealth, which in turn severely delayed the onset of industrialization and modern accounting in the region.
It is staggering to realize how the absence of one abstract legal concept can entirely alter the economic trajectory of half the globe.
It perfectly illustrates how deeply the mechanisms of jurisprudence weave into the very fabric of a civilization's survival and growth.
It really does.
Yeah.
Which brings us to a final thought for you to ponder based on this massive stack of sources today.
We've covered a lot of ground.
We really have. We've traced this concept from a literal survival path in the desert, We've watched human scholars draw wildly complex maps over centuries, unpacked a criminal justice system that was sociologically engineered against its own punishments,
and examined a system currently fracturing across the internet and colliding with modern economics and human rights.
Right. And the overarching theme of your sources is that early Islamic law was never a static monolith. It was fiercely dynamic.
It absorbed the Safavid pilgrimage rituals, it integrated Byzantine market rules, and it domesticated pre-Islamic tribal blood money customs.
It survived by synthesizing the divine ideal with the practical realities of the societies it encountered. So, if Sharia is fundamentally this living tradition that historically evolved by absorbing the customs of the world around it, we leave you with this question.
What does it absorb next?
Exactly. When this ancient framework fully collides with the hyper-connected, digitized, and culturally blended realities of the 22nd century, what new administrative customs will it integrate? What will the cartographers of tomorrow's map decide is the true path to water?
It is an open question, and history suggests the answer will be vastly more pragmatic than the headlines ever portray.
Thank you for sharing your notes and joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the buzzwords, look past the headlines, and we'll see you on the next one.